The World Tomorrow. As recorded before a live audience in a nationwide speaking campaign, Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
How many hours would you say it takes to make a savage out of a civilized human being? They say it takes up to 50 years, maybe a couple of generations, some people argue heredity and environment, to make a civilized human being out of a savage. Many people, especially in southern Africa, who argue about white or black minority governments, feel that some of the people in those civilizations are about 50 years behind European and American civilization. But believe it or not, a civilized human being who has the same values that most of you have, who believes basically in integrity, honesty, thrift, hard work, believes in being truthful, at least to a degree, a human being of the Judeo-Christian ethic in Western civilization can be made into a savage in only moments. As a matter of fact, people can become so utterly, totally, recklessly, emotionally abandoned involving certain situations that they can revert to savagery, whether you're talking about the floor of the United States Senate, or whether you're talking about a military conference, or whether you're talking of a group of religionists getting together to argue doctrine. I've seen people turn into virtual savages at football games. I've seen people turn into virtual savages in traffic jams, waiting in line. Perhaps some frustrating situation that comes along to just boggle their minds until some people fall apart at the seams. They say that there are over 10 million Americans that have serious mental problems, but there are millions more that are so emotionally distraught that any number of situations can cause them to revert to virtual savagery. I remember so well the British story about the psychologist who said that he knew how to take a person all the way from frustration to absolute paralyzation, just virtual exhaustion, person going almost insane in a matter of a few moments. And he said, I'll prove it to you. These two psychologists were sitting up very late at night. It was about 3 a.m., I guess, and he simply flipped open the telephone book in Greater London and put his finger at random on the page, and they called a number. Of course, obviously, it rang quite a while. It was very late, and some sleepy voice said, hello. He said, hello. He said, is Mr. Smedley there? No, you got the wrong number. Bang. And so the guy put the phone down. He said, now watch me really irritate him a lot more. And so he called back and dialed the same number about 5 minutes later, let him get back to sleep. And he said, that was Mr. Smedley there. He said, no, you got the wrong number. Bang! And he really hit the cradle pretty hard with a telephone receiver this time. He said, now watch me utterly frustrate this person to the point he'll virtually be a beast and a savage by the time he gets his next call. So he dialed again about 5 minutes later. He says, hello, my name is Smedley. Have there been any calls for me? And you can imagine what this person felt. Now, you know, it doesn't take very much to cause people to revert to virtual savagery in the way they treat one another. I well remember one parent who lost his temper and almost beat his child to death with a coat hanger. I've seen people use the same methods on their children they use on their horses. I've seen people get so frustrated that in family arguments and fights, they will literally kill one another. I say I've seen them. I mean, I've read about them. I've heard about them. I've had knowledge of it. I've told on the broadcast many times how even some of the most sobering occasions are the family occasions of the year, such as over Christmas turkey or Thanksgiving dinner. People have gotten so angry in arguments that they have simply shot it out. There was one occasion where an uncle and I believe a nephew had a fight over Thanksgiving turkey and ended up grabbing a carving knife and one of them stabbed the other one. Just the other day, because of all the CBs in the United States, there were neighbors. Where was this? California somewhere. There were some guys that were talking on CB, I believe it was up in Van Nuys area, in the Los Angeles area, and apparently they knew who they were. They had these handles and this strange jargon they get into, and they got into an argument on Citizens Band Radio, and the argument got hotter and hotter, and so pretty soon the one guy drove into the other's driveway and whipped out a gun and started shooting and killed him in an argument over Citizens Band Radio. It doesn't take very much to make a person revert to virtual savagery. I know that in the war camps, when prisoners of war have been deprived of food, water, and they have reverted to such bestial conduct that you don't really want to talk about that in public. It's not something you want your mind to dwell upon, but I think it is good to ponder how quickly deprived of food, deprived of freedom, deprived of the ability to move about as you wish to do, to think the way you want to think and act the way you want to act, that you can become so frustrated you will do almost anything to change your situation. You know, the Bible talks about a time in the future when they who have been brought up in purple shall embrace dunghills. Now that is by analogy showing that people who have lived a life of affluence, a life of wealth, a life of comfort and of ease, can very quickly lay their head down just to rest their tired old body on even a mound of, as they say, I guess, what do they call them? Anyway, you know what they are. We used to use them for second base in the lot where I played outside the school in Eugene, Oregon. But at any rate, people will actually embrace dunghills. I mean, lay their head down, because that is of some value to them at that time. Now, that has happened, and without belaboring the issue of all the wars of the world and all the people who have been deprived of those things and who have actually reverted into a virtual bestial or savage condition, let's just ask the question. In all of humankind, in all the experience, whether atheists and evolutionists think that we have come from the jungle and climbed down from the trees, or whether, which is true, the footprints of humankind lead away from the Middle East and the ancient cradle of civilization was there in the Tigris and Euphrates Valley and right there in the area that we call Palestine or Israel today, how far have we come in all of these nearly 6,000 years of recorded human history from a virtual savage condition? People think we started out as savages. We didn't. The truth is, the further people got away from cultural centers and areas of knowledge, and of course from the knowledge of God, the more bestial and the more savage they became. But we're modern today. We live in a space age. We travel in aircraft that go 600 miles an hour, subsonic, and some people, of course, now supersonic. We live in a space age. Men have walked and even shot a golf ball on the moon. We've got American flags and American paraphernalia parked up there that I guess will be there from now on. We're a pretty sophisticated society. Surely we are not a group of beasts or savages, are we? Well, you stop to think about what makes the world go round today. You stop to think about the attitudes of people, about exactly what it is they want in life, and what is happening to the entirety of the world around us. What are those basic motives which drive human beings? Now, in our free enterprise society, the one basic motive which really is resulting in the affluence that we have, in all of the breakthrough in technology, all of the marvelous inventions that we use, from our automobiles to the clothing, the synthetic building materials, the age of plastics in which we live, is basically the profit-making motive. It is the motive of wealth, of success, of getting ahead, and it is the motive that is called competition. If we didn't have a competitive society, we wouldn't be successful from the point of view of being affluent. The Soviet Union doesn't allow that. In a collective society, there is no competition, but we have competition. Now, in a free society that is not governed of God, there is nothing wrong with competition, so long as you're going to live in a society that denies its creator, that does not worship, does not obey that creator, then competition can be a motive, and government can have a system of checks and balances where everybody is spying on somebody else, where one agency is checking on another agency, which in turn is being supervised by a bureau, which is being watched by a special Senate committee, who are being watched by the constituency and the voters back home, who are watching each other, who are also being watched by the government and spied upon by the CIA, who in turn is being spied upon by a special White House committee, who in turn is being watched by the President, who is being watched by the Congress, who is being checked upon by the Senate, who is being checked upon by the state senates and the constituency back home, and all of them are watching each other. And so in a free society like ours, everybody watches everybody. And the consequences are that we believe everybody's a liar. Now, since society is founded on lies, it shouldn't come as a shock to us that the average person in the United States believes that government leaders are liars. It's kind of a little bit of a shock. You feel a little embarrassed to see during the great debates here of a time ago a man stand right there and call a president of the United States a liar to his face. Saying, now again, that is a gross distortion. I mean, you know, in plain words, you are a liar, sir. Minus the sir, I guess. But that's the way they tend to talk. Isn't it strange the way the American voters tend to think that things are going to change just because an election comes and goes? Isn't it strange the frustrated hopes of people who actually believe that we are civilized? That we have come to the point where it is unthinkable to plunge the world in a nuclear war? It is unthinkable to allow human beings by the millions to starve to death. that it is unthinkable to see this world actually descending into a new dark age of an absence of freedom. All the while, a group of first-class citizens representing about 6% of the entire population of the world are screaming one word over and over again, more. Give me more. I want more. Now, there are several great myths that United States people have held dear and have held to be true. These are total myths. They are not true. They are absolute error. The first myth is the United States will always have enough food. It isn't true, but millions of people, the broad majority, believe it. The second myth is government can solve inflation. That is a myth, but people believe it. The next is that there are vast areas around the world, the Amazon jungle and the like, that can produce additional food, including even the farming of the oceans, in order to stave off massive global starvation. A myth. The next is that the United States will become completely independent on energy by 1980, and we will have safe and clean nuclear reactors providing all the energy for the goods and services, all of the flow of energy to the big factories, and to keep our production going by 1980. That is a myth. The next great myth is the next generation, all these little kids sitting out here, your children and mine, will be more affluent than we are. They will live in a world which will give them even more goods and more services. They will have an easier life. They will have a more healthful life, a longer life. The government is going to come along and give them a guaranteed minimum wage, a 3 or a 4 day work week, guaranteed national health insurance program. American people believe in that. They believe in slogans of change. And they hope that the United States, representing 6% of those first-class citizens, living and wallowing around in 50% of all the wealth of the world, can continue to survive, can live in a world where freedom is disappearing, where despotism, anarchistic military dictatorships are rising almost weekly in countries all around the world, and that we can keep pushing the future back a few more years, a few more decades, and we can have it all. And we can continue to have it all. Do you remember the story about the ancient king in Israel that cried and sobbed and turned his back to the wall and begged God to give him a new lease on life? And so God finally gave him 15 years. Well, you know, Hezekiah was supposed to be one of the righteous kings. Although he had a lot of mistakes, a lot of problems that he made that weren't really right in God's sight. But when it came right down to it, at the end of his kingdom, God told him that by the time your sons are grown up, I'm going to send the country into a horrible state of captivity. All kinds of hideous things are going to happen. Drought and famine and curses are going to descend in the country. Nevertheless, because you've done thus and such, you will have peace in your day. And good old Hezekiah showed us a little bit of an insight into human nature. He sighed with relief. And he said, well have you spoken. Isn't it marvelous that at least to the end of my life, we can have peace in this country? It seems that people are willing, if they can have their share and their day in the sun, to push the future out of their minds into the future and forget about it, and maybe tomorrow will never come. Do you know that 1976 was the worst year in the last decade for freedom? Because of what happened in India, for example. All told, there are 803.6 million people in 40 nations, and 17 dependent territories, that's 19.8% of the population of the world, who live in virtually complete freedom. And those nations include Australia, Britain, most of northwestern Europe, the United States, and Canada. But there are 1,436,000,000 in 53 nations and 31 dependencies who live in only partial freedom. Nations like Egypt or Argentina, where they have single parties. But by far the biggest group of all of mankind, 1,823,000,000 in 65 nations and free dependencies, or almost 45% of the totality of the earth, live under dictatorship, forms of government that deny basic civil rights, where people are reduced to an animal level of existence, where they have no freedom of speech, no right of public assembly, no freedom of religion. You can define freedom perhaps in one way, and that is if a person lives in a country that is free, can he leave? Almost half of the human race cannot. They live in countries where that's where they stay. They cannot simply decide, I want to go somewhere and visit somebody in some other country. As a result of what happened in India, where the leader of India, Indira Gandhi, declared martial law, virtually a national emergency, abolished the other organizations of parliamentary democracy as it was, placed herself in absolute control, jailed tens of thousands of all the people who were against her in one way or another. So that nation, which had at least a certain semblance of freedom before that time, has descended into a complete dictatorship. Country after country has gone the same way. Our own hemisphere, Cuba, recently Angola, Mozambique, nations all over Africa, where there is a minority government in charge, brutally discriminating against a vast majority. Black against black. The United States Secretary of State has not necessarily visited all of those nations where that is happening, and the list is unbelievable. You can read about all those nations, whether in Africa or around the world. Burundi, Central African Republic, Chad. What about Chile and what happened there? Cuba in our own hemisphere. You can talk about Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, nations all over Africa, Malawi. Now, Tanzania and Kenya are not quite so bad, but some of these other countries are absolute dictatorships, as is Uganda. And you heard, of course, what happened at the university after the son of Big Dada, Idi Amin, was somehow myth because some of the girls were spurning his attentions, and his attentions were rather overt, rather obvious, right out in the bright light of day. What he wanted to do, put it bluntly, was to rape the girls. Now, the girls didn't like that. Big Daddy's boy walked around with a chest full of medals, swaggering around the campus, and he was a bully boy that was kind of putting himself on all these people. They didn't like it, and so he went home and he told Daddy. Daddy didn't like it either. So he sent the army over to the university. You probably read the story. They walked over there with submachine guns and shot the university to bits. And they slaughtered, I don't know how many dozen students, and all the other thousands of students simply left, took off back to the bush. That university in Uganda, the capital city of Entebbe, was destroyed by a mad, insane, last stages syphilitic dictator who rules with an iron fist over these millions of people and who dared to say, at the time of the rescue of those Israelis by that commando raid, where I believe it was Governor Reagan who said, for once, it almost makes everybody believe that the Israelis are acting like the Americans ought to act. But anyway, we did in the Mayaguez incident, I guess. But that was an unbelievable, hair-raising, and almost a fabulous tale right out of, I guess, a great novel somewhere. But if you read the book, it came out so quickly in the aftermath of that Entebbe incident, 90 Minutes at Entebbe. It's an incredible book. And I would want to ask you, if you didn't, get a chance, borrow one, and especially read the record of the speeches made by Chaim Herzog, who was the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, that he made before that entire assembly, because it's an absolute curse on the UN. He said, I stand here as the accuser of this body. And I mean, one point after another, he listed what is wrong with that so-called United Nations, which I call the disunited non-nations, and have urged for many years that we buy it, or better yet, sell it to the Arabs and then nationalize it. But whichever. Maybe we could make more money if we sold it to the Arabs and then nationalized it. But if we don't do that, we simply ought to kick them all out and go it alone, because the United Nations is a hollow sounding box for communist and third world non-aligned propaganda against the United States of America. What if you did live like the other half lives? How would you feel? And what in the world would you do? You know, I've tried to ponder that as I've traveled around in various places like that in the world and see these teeming millions of people going by on their bicycles or walking by without shoes on, and think, what if that were but for the grace of God, there go I. You've heard, but for the grace of God, there go I. Well, you know, most of the world does not live in freedom. Now, we freedom lovers in the United States demand such impossible things of our candidates that we make them try to sit in the middle of the fence, keep both ears of the ground on the same side, try to find out which way the wind is blowing, and try to satisfy everybody. We demand that they satisfy Protestants and Catholics, Jews and Christians, white and black, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. And they desperately try to do precisely that. They try to satisfy everybody, give everybody what they want. We've got some poverty-stricken people in the United States who, by comparison, with those millions of other people in those hundreds of countries around the world, live like kings. But we don't know that, and we have no sense of comparison. Our sense of comparison are the people going by on the freeways in their beautiful brand new 77 or whatever automobile. And so because of that fact, we tend to compare our poor with our affluent. And it's wrong that we have any poor in this country. So we have government welfare programs, and Medicaid, and Medicare, and food stamps. And we're arguing about guaranteed minimum wages and guaranteed national social, and it is socialism, I think, health programs, such as health insurance. There are, how many million people are there on welfare? Well, I'll tell you one thing, it's long been suspected by American voters, and the economists have absolutely proved it, that there are far more people in the United States of America who are dependent on your tax dollars than there are enough of you to support them. Let me give you the actual facts. If you add up all government employees, the military on active duty, the disabled and the unemployed, the retired and those on welfare, that stacks up to be a total of 80,655,000 human beings in the United States who are dependent upon a government check. They are tax dependent. 80,655,000 of them. Now, how many people are there out here in private enterprise who are working, paying taxes to foot those bills and give those people those checks? Not that many. There are only 71,650,000 non-government workers. Did you know that? Did you know that the government payroll is bigger than all of private enterprise and all other corporate payrolls in the entirety of the country? And you can search history, and you can find that any time any nation got to that point, a social welfare state where there were more people who were dependent upon a shrinking working class, the country was headed down the drain. It was on its last legs. It was on the way out. We believe in the impossible. We expect the impossible. We demand of government that they play God. We want government to give us more welfare instead of what government ought to do. What ought government to do about welfare? Take it away except from the non-able-bodied. I mean, a person without arms and legs ought to be on welfare. A person who cannot work because they're so desperately ill they cannot move ought to be on welfare. A person who is able-bodied should not. You know what the Bible says about that? If Jesus Christ of Nazareth were the President of the United States, you know what he'd say about welfare? I can quote it to you out of 1 Thessalonians if you'd like to turn and read it. If any will not work, neither shall he eat. You know that Jesus Christ would not hand anything to a man who is able-bodied except a broom or a shovel or an axe. And then later on, after the job's done, he'd hand him a loaf of bread and maybe some butter and honey to go along with it. But he would not hand that person, an able-bodied person, anything except a tool or an implement to get out and get busy with. The Bible preaches pump priming. It doesn't preach social welfare. Now, in the United States of America, we have the notion that a new government is going to come along and is going to give everything that everybody wants. The people in the Democratic Party want more programs, they want more money, they want more government printing presses to grind out more money, and they want to get their hands on more money. They want shorter work weeks, more fringe benefits, longer vacations, higher wages. And at the same time, they want government to control all this inflation. We want the government to stop inflation, but we want more. Look at all of the paradoxical things we tend to demand of government that is absolutely ridiculous. The United States citizens don't like the idea that the Soviet Union has been able in the last few years, and it's now been announced and should have been just like a bombshell in the news, but it's been swept under the carpet, that the Soviet Union has now completely altered the entire Cold War strategy of the United States since the early 1950s. Because they now have a mobile defense unit which is able to jam American MIRVs, which completely makes null and void our Minuteman stationary strategic missile system, which is the absolute bulwark, the main arm of our nuclear defense against the Soviet Union. The policy of the 50s, which was incumbent upon the presidents of the 60s and even on into the 70s, because you have to realize that decisions taken by previous administrations, two or three or four earlier, tend to be incumbent upon new administrations, and they tend to be pushed along and propelled into decisions they might not even want to make, which is simply the way the world is going. But for all of those years, our entire strategic nuclear policy was to be able to absorb a first nuclear blow from the Soviet Union and then to hand them such massive retaliation as to make nuclear war unthinkable. But now we find that the Soviet Union has not been following the policy that nuclear war is unthinkable, but they have been following the policy that if nuclear war comes, and it surely will, and so consequently, our policy of being able to deal massive retaliation, which is unacceptable to them, has now been nullified because of their ability to defend up to 90% of their civilian populaces and their industrial centers and their military bases, instead of about 40 or 30 or less, which we thought was true through the 50s and the 60s. They now have a new portable radar system, which is capable of ringing their major centers of population and their defense centers, and jamming, apparently, those warheads on our MIRVs that would be launched. The two strategic systems we have are the Minuteman system and the Poseidon Polaris, or the Polaris submarine with the Poseidon missile, which is an IRBM system. Now, the Soviet Union has been moving ahead in conventional weapons. They have a newer, bigger, more modern navy than we do. So what do Americans want? They want to be number one, don't they? And they demand it of any new president. Now what else do they want? They want vast cuts in defense spending. Isn't that amazing? How dumb can we be? We can't have both. We cannot be number one and have vast cuts in defense budget. We can only be number one if we begin to spend proportionate to the way some of the nations in the Middle East are spending. We're spending, what is it, about 4%, the last I heard, of the total national budget on defense. Those nations are spending 16% and more, quadruple what we spend proportionate to their annual national budget. Only if we were to spend 16, 20, 30, 40, 50%, close to what the Soviet Union does, on defense, would we continue to be number one? We demand of our president we be number one. We also demand that he cut military spending. Americans in both parties want all these personal, social, socioeconomic benefits. And yet, even though they demand anti-poverty programs, food programs, welfare programs, relief programs, they demand help and aid for the farmers, they demand subsidies, they demand emergency aid and disaster area declaration for emergency aid when a flood comes along and wipes out somebody's crop or tears down homes and towns. But at the same time, they want to do away with big government. They want to do away with big government spending. But they want the government to spend more on more and more programs.
This topic will be continued on the next edition in series of The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong. You're invited to learn more about these important issues through the pages of Plain Truth. This International Journal of Understanding comes along every month with a penetrating analysis of world news in the light of Bible prophecy. Correspondents from around the world explain seemingly unrelated events and bring you the good news beyond. Plain Truth. Your subscription is free of charge. There's no cost or obligation. Plain Truth. You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.